Welcome to the Naked Podcaster. Get ready to hear stories of someone brave enough to bear it all. Let's get naked.
Hello and welcome to the Naked Podcaster live. Today I have with me Dwayne Clayton. Dwayne, how are you today?
I'm doing great, thank you.
This is so fun.
This is awesome. I'm glad to be back.
Yes, that's what I wanted to say. You have been on before, and so I'm super excited that you're on again. Let's catch up. I have lots of information about you. I've purchased a couple of your books.
Excellent.
Yay. But you've had some changes since we last spoke. It's been a little while. So I want to jump in again, especially because I want to give people who want to write, you're a different breed of writer. Let's start with
a good thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Let's jump in here. I am an author, but I'm not a writer, and I do write almost every day, but it's not my career. And so I put someone who is a writer in the category of this is your career. It's what you do for a job. So not only do you write every day, but like you write hours every day, like you would for a normal job. Right.
Right. Yeah, that's for sure.
Jump in and talk about that, because I have written a book and I'm writing another book and I do lots of blogs, but I'm not a writer, so to speak. I wouldn't put myself in that. So tell me about your writing and kind of how you structure your time.
All right. Well, I mean, I started probably like lots of people. I had a full-time job and was writing on the side and then quite enjoyed it. And then I heard some authors who are full-time talk about writing 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,000 words a day. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's pretty incredible, but I can do it. And I sat down and probably stopped at about 900 words the first time I tried, and that was it. My brain was fried. And so then I worked up to it a bit. So it's not like I could sit and write for 8 hours a day, like it was a real job. And so it was kind of like, you know, if you're preparing for a marathon, you can't just go out and run 26 miles. You might walk around the block 3 times. And then the next week you walk around the block 5 times, et cetera, and you work up to it. So that took a while to work up to numbers. I've had a few days where I wrote about 6,500 words. So a novel that I'm writing, give or take 80 to 85,000 words. So I put a pretty good dent in it in the one day, but I didn't maintain that every day afterwards. It was kind of like I did that one day, I did it the next day, and then it was like I needed a week vacation because I'd used up every brain cell I had on those. So you know, over the week I ended up with like 14,000 words, which was pretty good, but I did 12,000 of them in 2 days. So now it's sitting down and writing 2,000, 2,500 words is pretty easy. So, but that's because I worked up to it. You know, I'm not at the marathon where I can do 6,000 all the time, but you know, I can do a 10K sort of thing as far as writing goes.
And I love the running analogy. Okay. That's awesome.
Yeah. Now if I was to go out and try and run, I would last the one time around the block. But as far as writing goes, I'm okay. And then I think some of it is about figuring out your when's the right time to write. The better time for me to write is in the afternoon. So kind of like about from now on forward. So we're at, you know, noon Pacific time right now. So from now till 5 or 6 would be good. Sometimes I'll start as early as, you know, 10 or 11. But usually I need to get into it a little bit. I answer emails to start with, kind of get the business, the nagging stuff out of the way. So I'm not thinking about that later on when I'm trying to write. And then I'll read the last chapter or two that I wrote and try and get back in the characters' heads, and off I go.
Tucker Max has a writing program, or you can sign up for it. And he recommends, because like you said, you start off with a job, right? His recommendation has always stuck with me because I think it's so easy. It's so realistic. If you write 250 words a day, you can get 120 page, which is about 30,000 word first draft done in 4 months.
Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of my favorite sayings is you can't eat an elephant in one bite.
No, exactly.
And I mean, like, so when you said 6,500 words, I was like, I can't I wrote my book pretty fast, and I have no idea how much I wrote per day, but that is outstanding. But it's now your job. You're now a writer. It's what you do for a living. When and how did you make the transition from author to writer? Because that's a big jump. You had to not have your job anymore.
Yeah, well, it was, I guess, a big lifestyle change for me because I had a job steady for 42 years. I had never had a break between jobs. When I changed jobs, I finished the one, they use up my vacation of 2 weeks, but I still started the next job the next week. I didn't use that vacation.
Right.
And so I had done that my entire life. So there was a bit of a, retirement was a little bit of a shock. I mean, emergency services is high action. And even when you're managing, I would manage small services. So I was actively involved. So there's that adrenaline rush. And then all of a sudden that adrenaline rush isn't there anymore. And it's like running full speed into a wall. It just all ends. Mm-hmm. So then for me, the writing kind of took over. The adrenaline rush is in the characters that I use, the stories that I set up, how the plot goes, that sort of thing. So I guess that's how I made the transition. So I guess I changed it from physically doing these things to mentally setting them up and setting up the characters to do them.
How fun. Now things have changed for you January 2021. What changed?
Well, let's see, January 2021.
Around there.
Yeah, well, I'm going full speed on the books now. So as you said, writing full-time writer, my goal is 3 a year. And I've set that up with my editor. So that puts lots of pressure on me.
Yeah.
Working with my publicist, Mickey, on Creative Edge, I was the writer who finished the book, tried to get it printed as soon as I could and had a launch like the next week. And there were lots of times where I was actually picking up the books the afternoon of the launch because they had one box of books for me because I left things too late. So now he's convinced me to set things up a little bit better, take my time with it, advertise the books. As of April 22nd, the launch of Goddess of Justice will be my sixth novel. So since April, I can't remember what the date was, April 7th or 14th, maybe, 2018, I'm now publishing my sixth book. I have a seventh that could be published any moment, but I'm holding on to that one a bit. There'll be a nonfiction book, hopefully this summer, and then the sequel to Speargrass, Opioid, which was a new series I started last summer, will come out this fall. And I got my schedule set up till I think 2025 of when things would happen.
Holy cow. Okay. So what I was remembering January 2021, and it was Laughing Dog. That was about Laughing Dog.
Yeah.
That's with your editor.
Yeah. Well, so that's the one that's done. So I just had a friend who's a beta reader who I thought had the perfect personality to read it because it's a little bit of a different story, which I'll talk about in a second. Yeah. So he was the perfect one to look at it. I have been self-publishing up to now. I'm going to give traditional publishing a shot. And so The Laughing Dog, I am going to work on getting an agent and a traditional publisher. So who knows where that will go? Initially with Crisis Point, my first book, I went through a year and a half of 37 rejections.
I want to talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So that pushed me to independent publishing, which has worked great for me.
Yeah.
I've got the books out. There's no way with a traditional publisher, you can put out more than really with most one book a year. Whereas now I can put out three and I'm getting that stable of books that people read one, they want to read the next one and they'll read the next one. And now in the Coulter series, we're up to five. So that's great. So Laughing Dog is just something different. It's based on a short story I wrote in 2015. The character, if you imagine, he is a Humphrey Bogart, Philip Marlowe, Sam Spade character who's in 2019. He wears a fedora. He wears He wears a suit. He wears some flashy ties. He talks with 1940s slang. In his mind, he really kind of thinks he's Bogey and acts that way, except it's so natural to him. When people comment on it, he doesn't get what they're saying. And sometimes he comes across as bumbling because of this and being silly, but he's actually a very brilliant man who has, as I guess most characters do, not a checkered past, but there's things that happened in the last 10 years in his life that have really made him the person who he is right now. And that's a guy that's got a lot of, well, he's got a lot of flaws and he's carrying some baggage, lots of baggage. And so we talked about that before. Well, I mean, the baggage is some PTSD. And so you and I talked about that last time. And that's fortunately something I can add realism to in his story. So it's fun. I guess in all my characters, the dialogue is funny. I mean, they pick on each other. There's laughs back and forth. And when things get serious, it gets serious. This guy, his name is Bryce Pedley. And I think I've taken him to as far to the edge of that silliness, sarcasm as I can. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think it's my truest writing. That in that character, with Brad Coulter, I put some of my police personality when I was a recruit a long time ago and learning the system. I think this Bryce Pedley is more me, not really with a police background, kind of the, I like to party. I like to have fun. I like to tell jokes. I just liked having fun with people around a campfire or something. I would tell jokes for 2 hours and have people laughing. So this Pedley is more that way, and he'll almost do anything for the laugh. And if that means, you know, poking fun at himself, then he'll do that too.
So you're on book 9 and how many series?
Book 9 in 3 series. Coulter, there's 5. And then in Speargrass, there'll be 2 this year. And then Pedley, this one, The Laughing Dog, is brand new one in a new series.
It's not difficult for you to keep track of all your characters, though.
I think it was switching initially from Coulter over to Speargrass. Now it's not too bad. I have charts on the wall.
Behind me,
of all the characters. So I have things out there to remind me that this person has blue eyes, this person has hazel eyes, their hair is brown and short, and things like that. The Coulter series, I tend to write 2 of them at a time, and then one of the others. So I think it's because that is the easier series for me to write because I do know those characters the best.
Let's go back and talk about that a little bit, about your background, just a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was in emergency services for 42 years. I started out at 19 as a police officer, graduated when I was 20. I never should have given a 20-year-old a big gun and lots of authority, but they did. I didn't have a steady girlfriend, but I was going to domestics and trying to solve 20 years of marital problems with my vast 20-year-old experience. So those things were interesting. But that training that the police did really set everything in motion for me. There's still things that I learned, well, wherever we're at, 43 years ago when I started police training, that today I still remember, I still do, as far as being aware of things around me. Mm-hmm. Paramedics was a brand new profession in the late 70s into the 80s. So I kind of got in on the floor of that one, and we were learning as we went along. And that profession just really, really took off. And so both professions are helping, caring professions. There's a lot of similarities between the two. But that was great. And I took firefighter training in there when I was EMS chief in Airdrie. I created a program for tactical paramedics to work with SWAT teams. So I created the program, and then I taught the program, and then took the training with the team.
And then we were
So we're integrated into SWAT. So that was like, an adventure guy's fantasy weekend. It went on for a couple of weeks and we were shooting guns and we were playing hide and seek in the dark with night vision goggles. And so it was a lot of fun. And so all of that just brought a whole bunch of different pieces together that I can use in my stories.
I've bought several of your books. And I have read Crisis Point and Outlaw MC. I had to look them up because wanted to be absolutely sure. Yeah. And love them. So okay. I'm asking you questions today about your past. Cause when you said that you did the SWAT training and then you did the training, I'm like, Brad Coulter. I know that when you write, you're part of every character, or every character is a part of you, and you can take them and explode them in ways that you are unrealistic to do in real life. Like you can, part of your personality can be the murderer, you know what I mean? So obviously you're not going to be that part of your personality, hopefully, in real life. But I was curious when you said that, I was like, I'm seeing all these things that came up in the books, which I knew from our last conversation. But now that I have some, I have a barometer that's different now because I've read a couple of your books. So, and you talk about PTSD some in the books. As a matter of fact, your villains have PTSD and you're clear about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, definitely shaped by, I won't get too much away, but the guys in Crisis Point are ex-military who served overseas and served in firefights. And so that's very much left an impression on them and how they act. And the first in Crisis Point, there's a car chase in there where Brad is chasing a stolen MG. That's actually almost word for word, action for action of a chase I was in.
Which one?
So in Crisis Point, Brad is in a car chase and he's chasing this little MG that's kind of outrunning him. That was an actual call that I was on. That was actually the chase I was on. Actually, to write that one, I went back to the map and kind of tried to remember all the twists and turns I did and set that one up. So that was kind of fun. So there's not a ton of real Dwayne adventures in there, but that one was just one of the spectacular ones for me anyway. So I put that in the novel.
Yeah. I was glad that you addressed PTSD. It's a really huge, and I like that you're willing to talk about it. It's a really huge part of all of the professions. I mean, you hit like police, SWAT, fire, paramedic. Like, is there another PTSD profession I could sign up for? Like that was you. You're like, I could do that one. I'll do that one too. I know it was different back then, but you really kind of signed up and immersed yourself into real PTSD professions, or higher likelihood of, I guess.
Yeah, it's like you said, initially the saying was suck it up. You know, if that accident was too tough for you, then you should quit. You should leave, suck it up, because you shouldn't be here. Maybe you should go teach kindergarten or be a playground supervisor. And not to pick on any of those professions, but there is, I suppose, a bit of a type for these professions. I mean, one, you have to be a caring person, first off, and then you have to be willing to do whatever it takes to help somebody. And whatever that takes is putting yourself at risk. I mean, from seemingly simple things like a car accident where I'm crawling in through the back window to look after a patient while I'm crawling through glass, sticking up in all sorts of places. But the type of person who will succeed is the person who doesn't see those things, if that makes any sense.
I
have a focus, so if that means I'm crawling over broken glass to get to the patient, then I'm crawling over broken glass to get to the patient. And not that I'm doing it in a t-shirt and shorts by any means. You've got good gear, but you're still crawling in there. So I think you have to be a person of action, but being a person of action means you put yourself way out there. And it adds up. Not for everybody. Some people are able to take that piece of action and put it somewhere and it stays in the box in their brain, in the back corner of their brain, or they've got other ways of working it out, talking it out with people, with family. But a lot of us don't talk it out with family because we don't want the family to bear that burden. We don't want to tell them what we saw last night, what we had to do last night. So we keep it inside. Yeah. And sometimes it explodes. And that's what happened for me in 2017. It's like, I thought I was fine. And within 15 minutes, I was no longer fine. And it was a huge crash.
What happened in that 15 minutes?
Well, it's totally unrelated. I had an appointment with my doctor. I played lots of sports. And so I've got bad knees. And so I was thinking I might need knee surgery. So I went in to see my doctor just about this. I've known her for a number of years. And she walked in and looked at me and more or less said, "You look like crap. What's going on?" And I started talking. And 45 minutes later, I stopped talking. So obviously, that was kind of the moment where I talked about it. If I look back in the prior 6 months, I could see a whole bunch of places where I wasn't functioning well, or I had snapped or yelled at somebody or got mad or angry. Something about that day when she asked that question, it was, I guess, a safe place for me to be, mm-hmm. a safe person to tell. And all that stuff that I talked about that was blocked up in the back of my head, all of a sudden released.
What did it look like for you when you say you were not functioning well? What did that, you said yelling at somebody or snapping at somebody, but what did it really look like to you that 6 to 12 months before that conversation?
Well, I was definitely agitated and frustrated. In no job do you get your way in everything. But for some reason, I thought I should get my way on everything. And so I just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. On some of the things looking back, I'll still say, I believe I was right.
Okay.
But you have to pick the hill to die on. And the thing was, I wasn't picking the hill. I was picking all the hills. I was going to the mat on everything that came up. I wasn't letting the ones go that I should let go. I was fighting all of them as if they all were where I'm going to make my stand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think it's the right person, the right time, the right place. It's a lot of things, but I can think of moments in my life where you're not necessarily, even if you are thinking about how being agitated or you are thinking about how something's off and it's not right. Even in that situation, you hadn't gotten there, but even when you are, it's the right person in the right time that just says, "Hey, how you doing today?" That makes you like all of a sudden verbally vomit. So I want to share something interesting also on the PTSD thing. I personally have had a theme of suicide and people dying in my life. Mm. And my neighbor shot himself in the head with a revolver and I was the one that found him. And, my stepmother also committed suicide in a different state. And I struggle more with my stepmother than the fact that my neighbor, our families did stuff together all the time. We were very close. It was very unexpected. And, I was the first person on scene, which meant a lot of things that were weird to me in that moment. And I remember thinking looking at my phone, like, this lady, obvious on 911 has no clue what she's asking me. Mm-hmm. She said, "Do you have a defibrillator?" And I was like, "Why in the world?" Like, I'm just neighbor, and I was like, "No, I don't have a defibrillator." And she's like, "Do you know CPR?" I said, "You don't understand. Mm-hmm. There are brains coming out of his nose and the blood is coagulating and there are flies. He has to have been dead for 2 hours. How did I even know that? I was right. I was 100. I was so accurate. It was scary, but I don't know. I mean, like, I was just... And I have so many questions. I can't even tell you since that time 10 years ago, I want to see the photos in the worst way because I have so many questions between my memory and what I actually saw. I know that, you fill in the blanks, right? But that was a traumatic thing to walk in on, which you can relate to. Mm-hmm. And yet for me, it was more traumatic hearing over the phone that my stepmom had committed suicide with pills and alcohol. No brains anywhere. And I think it's just interesting, like you said, you don't know what's going to trigger you and what's not. And sometimes personalities and where you are in your life and a million different things, it's like that is the one that triggers you. And another one that's seemingly so much worse, right? I've seen horrific car accidents and been first on scene. Probably should have just been a paramedic. So I would have just gotten there first on purpose, right? Yeah. But yeah, it's really interesting how that hits you. What did the doctor say to you after verbally vomiting for 45 minutes?
Well, as I recall, I don't think it was her first words. There was concern first, but I do remember her saying, "You're not going to work for 30 days.
Oh, that must have killed you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I thought, yeah, okay. So I'll take a couple of days off and I'll be back to work by Wednesday. So this was a Monday, you know, so I'll be back to work by Wednesday, Thursday for sure. The next Monday, absolutely. And then it was almost, I guess, once I had released everything that was built up, it kept releasing.
Yeah.
So there was an endless supply of emotion. And even, you know, a year and a half, 2 years later, I could spontaneously cry. Not sure what triggered it, not sure where it came from, but all of a sudden I would just feel this wave of sadness, emotion, and I would just start crying. And you're at a family dinner, you're sitting around with family watching TV or just with friends, and all of a sudden, and I never tried to dissect it backwards. So I'm pretty sure something was said that was innocent by whoever said it, but for whatever reason, it was a key that unlocked something in my brain. And initially I missed it, but my brain caught it. Mm. And there's a couple of times where I do know the thing that happened, and, you know, I was very controlled about it. We were at the dinner table and a few things were said, and that just triggered me. I picked up my plate, took it to the kitchen, scraped off the plate, put it in the dishwasher, turned around and went into the bedroom and curled up in a ball and just cried. It doesn't happen as much anymore, but there still are sometimes. And so, you know, it sticks with you. And you know, the craziest thing though is I was the caregiver. I was the boss for quite a while. I looked after my staff. I knew when they were struggling. I knew when they were having problems. I knew when I needed to put my arm around their shoulder and pull them aside and say, "Hey, you want to have a talk? We should sit down. Let's go for a coffee. Let's go for a walk." I knew how to recognize that in everybody else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Especially when as a mom, that's how I feel, right? I mean, that's different, but we've had kids go through all kinds of different things. And that's why parents are a huge demographic, especially the moms that are the caretakers all the time, that completely forget who they are and what they liked and what the self-care mean, like on a daily basis. You know, that's like a pedicure every couple of years when you get it as a gift certificate. And just you lose yourself in that and you don't recognize how much help you need. There's so many things like that.
Yeah.
You had the buildup and you had the conversation. I would think that was absolutely like just a dam.
Yeah.
Just a dam bursting.
Yeah, it was. Like I said, I mean, I grew up in the system first where it was suck it up. So you just figured a way to do it. And a lot of that was in forgetting. So some guys, ladies I know who have put in 20, 30 years, remember all the calls they went on. I don't. I worked really hard to forget them. So we would do whatever it was, a situation now, take the patient to the hospital. By the time we're walking back to the ambulance, I was trying to forget that because I didn't want to remember it. And there used to be a thing as well where if you had a rookie and there was something particularly gruesome, you took the rookie to see it so they would be exposed to it. Not too long into my career, I learned that was just dumb. So I stopped that from happening because I had gone through that and I knew how that had affected me. So no, you don't need to see everything. And yep, you know, that very same thing you didn't see, maybe something you go to later, but surprisingly, you figure out how to deal with those things. I don't know many paramedics or police officers who could tell you exactly what they saw as they were going into a situation because they had something else to do. It wasn't about
right.
the blood. It wasn't about the mess. It was about what do I need to do to help this person? And mm-hmm. everything else was in the periphery. It was there, but wasn't the focus.
I would think it would be easier to see it in the moment than like, hey, come and see this.
Oh, yeah.
Like you're right. You're in the moment. You're so focused on what is happening and how to make the best positive impact that you're looking at it through a completely different lens where the rookie is just, it's just like, hey, you need to just see this. So you're, what a horrible, I mean, we've come a long way.
Yeah, you know, exactly. That's just it. Yeah, we have. And there's lots of people of my generation who unfortunately are kind of the examples, I guess, of what can happen or how we need to, you know, do things different from now on.
When I wrote my book, I was born in 1970, which it just is, right? And when I wrote my book about my life growing up, it was nonfiction. And I had to go back and study the 70s because I had lots of memories about the 70s. But they were from a child perspective. So I really had to go and study about the 70s so that what my perception was made sense and I could write about it. And holy crap. That was like the most incredibly enlightening part of writing the book because I didn't see it. I saw it from this lens of being a little kid growing up and things didn't make sense. So you yeah. were seeing it from the streets of a police officer and that was a really different time.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was huge. And I guess I use a little bit of that with the Brad Coulter. It's the change in policing as well. So, you know, there's always
yeah,
the
opportunity yeah.
of going through another one now, but in the late 70s into the 80s was another big change because a lot of the officers who became police officers after the Second World War
okay
now oh. retiring. So they hired literally in every service they hired hundreds of guys and it was only guys then
yep
and then in mid 70s into early 80s those guys were retiring and there was a huge hiring again this time of guys and ladies more of a mix. And all of the same generation too. So there was the old guard going out, the new guard coming in, and that created a lot of friction too. So the old guys were I'm not meaning to pick on them. The veterans though that came from the 40s and the 50s into police services, they were the ones who were set in the suck it up. And so that's
100%.
That's what they passed on. So
yeah.
You know, initially this new group coming in, we all bought into that. But eventually started saying, well, but why? Why do we have to do it this way? That led to change.
Well, but it must have been like the Vietnam vets coming into service at that point too.
Oh yeah. Well, exactly. And they kind of went two directions. So like I said, paramedics was coming on board at the same time. So the TV show Emergency started in 1972 and actually was the big catalyst for paramedics across the US and Canada. That one TV show really boosted paramedics. And so the Vietnam medics came back and here was a job for them. They could work on the ambulances and they had these great skills because they knew trauma yep. inside, upside down, all around. So they were perfect to go into those roles. Others went into the police departments because they were good with weapons. They had good, you know, peripheral vision, spidey senses, all that sort of stuff, which made them a good police officer. So as I said a couple times, you know, I think the jobs are somewhat interchangeable. The same personalities would be successful in either. And it just depends on which path you go. I picked police first, went to paramedics, worked out great for me.
How did firefighting fit into all that? Just a side job?
Well, it kind of was. It was just the service that I was working for at the time. So it was a paramedic fire service and everybody was cross-trained. So when I went there as the EMS chief, I had to train as a firefighter and that scared the crap out of me because I did not like masks on my face. Mm-hmm. So I dodged that for as long as I could because I didn't want to have to wear a mask. And then once we figured out how to cure me of the phobia, I actually love doing it. I think part of it for me though was I was the EMS chief. I was in charge of every EMS emergency on the fire truck. I was just a guy on the fire truck. I didn't have to make any decisions. Somebody told me what to do, or I knew the basic things I needed to do. So that was almost like a break from decision making. So that's how that one fit in. So that was for 5 years.
That's really interesting. When did you start writing the book in comparison with when you were working?
Oh, quite late. So I started writing in 2010.
Right.
So
when did you retire?
32 years into my career, really.
Right.
Is when I started writing. Through my paramedic career, I co-authored 4 textbooks for paramedics, but that was an entirely different style of writing. And actually, when I first started writing, a couple of the first instructors I had said, you write like you're writing a procedure manual.
You'd written 4.
I guess technically everything I was writing was bang on perfect. There wasn't a lot of emotion to it, the procedures were right. Yeah. So that was the learning, was switching that around from not showing off because I know how everything is done sort of thing, to bringing the emotion to it. And so for me, I think that started with I could do the dialogue, because I had those conversations with partners. So that was one place I could start that was, I guess, safe for me, but also it was right there. So I could have that conversation at 2 o'clock in the morning in February when there's nobody on the street. I know exactly what that conversation was, and I can put that into a book.
What an interesting way to start getting the emotion in there. That's really fantastic. You kind of reverse engineered some of it too. Mm-hmm. You were 32 years, you started writing, and then eventually so how much of a crossover was there? I know in the beginning you mentioned this, but you had written how much before you retired, and then you became a writer instead of an author?
Yeah, so it was probably close to 7 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. So quite a while you were writing at the same time you were working.
Yeah. Crisis Point was slow. It was about 7 years. But I was learning to write. And in some of the initial versions, the drafts, you could read and you could go, oh, his scene is much better here. He must have taken a class on scene writing, or his plot is better here. Oh, that must have been when he took. So then I had to go back and edit the whole thing, adding in the whole of the knowledge that I had learned. But for 4 years, I took writing classes pretty much back to back to back to back. And
that's a great way to segue into that, because you took a lot and you entered contests and you had a lot of feedback. Talk about that. I want to kind of speak to the aspiring authors out there about that journey for you.
Yeah, well, it was, you go in and like I said, I'd written those textbooks. So I guess I thought of myself as a writer. So I thought I knew some of that stuff. And I guess my best advice, if you're just starting to write, is go in like you don't know anything and ask the question. So I was just so certain on some ways I was going to write this. And even the first couple of instructors would say, no, you know, that's not the way to write it. They would say, do you read your genre? I'd say, yes. And I said, is that the way they write it? I'd say, no, but this is the way I'm going to write it. Well, I had a slow, you know, my learning curve was just a flat line. It took me a couple of years to realize, okay, it's not that I have to write like my favorite writers in the genre, but there is a way that they do it. And so I best pay more attention to my reading and how they're doing things than the actual book. And so actually it probably destroyed reading for me a little bit, because for quite a while, I read the book and dissected it, trying to figure out, okay, how's the plot going? What are they doing here? What are they setting up and all that sort of stuff, and kind of dissected it. So you just have to be willing to learn. And I know the first couple of times people critiqued my stuff. I took the stuff home and I was lying in bed and I'd lie there till 2 a.m. reading their critiques, thinking, how can they say this to me? This is horrible. And then you just have to learn to get thick skin. And it's not that they're always right, but a lot of the time they will be, or they'll say something like, I don't understand what you mean. And I'm going, what do you mean you don't understand? Well, that's just a hint to me that I need to write it differently, because they didn't catch that point. So don't get upset about it. You have to think about why are they saying this? And you go, okay, well, because that terminology makes perfect sense to me, but it doesn't make sense to 99.9% of the population. So why did I use that? It's just because as you're writing, stuff comes out. So medical terminology or whatever that would be.
Right. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of things that happen. Well, in books like the one you wrote, there's got to be a ton where you write it, but you have to go back and you have to go back because of medical terminology or medication or I can think of a whole bunch of stuff that would like it has to make sense. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's a made up story, but it has to also make sense. So if I have a certain background and somebody else has a certain background, and we read it, we're not like, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, you want it to make sense.
Yeah, I think that's one challenge with the paramedics.
Yeah,
you don't see paramedics as characters in many books. Mm. They may show up, they may transport, they may put on a splint, they cover the person, dead person up and leave. That's mostly what you see on TV for sure in a lot of books. But in my books, the paramedics are characters. So the challenge is taking these very complex medical skills that they're doing and putting, like you're saying, putting them into a context where you understand why they're doing it, what it is they're doing, and what they're hoping to gain from it. So that's a whole new, I guess, level of thinking for me.
Yeah.
Putting it so that everybody can understand it and understand it and not go, oh, you just put that for sensationalism or you just put that. I mean, I try to put it in because it's a skill, it's needed to save that person. So I try to explain it so it's understood.
When I was reading your first two books, I have so many questions, but one of the things that I found was that there were, and I don't know if this was from your experience, but when in your books, the SWAT team is brand new, like mm-hmm. they've never had one. It's very old school police styling and they don't allow them in. And so buildings get blown up or, you know, knocked down or whatever. And how much of that did you actually see?
I saw a bit of it. Some of that was just a little before I joined, but the one experience in that book where there's the guy high on glue.
Yeah.
That's an actual event from Calgary's history. So that happened. Okay. I fictionalized it.
Yeah.
But the plot is there. And actually in real life, that event was the catalyst for having a SWAT team. So I changed it around that there was already a SWAT team and then they weren't used when they should have been used. So I changed it around a little bit, but that in Calgary, that was December 20th, 1974. It was called Black Friday. And the really weird thing about this, now you really think I'm strange, is for whatever reason, as a 16-year-old kid, I kept those newspapers. And when I went to my first writing class and they said, you need to think of something to write, I went into a box in the garage and I pulled out a file folder that had those newspaper clippings in it. And that was, I used those to write the first story I ever wrote for a writing class. And that then it became part of the book.
Awesome.
I have no other newspaper clippings anywhere, but I had 2 days worth of news clippings from that event.
Oh, nice.
Or that I would need it, whatever it was, 40 years later that I would need those.
That was the event in the book that I was talking about, but there was an event before that also where it's like, just let us, why aren't you using us? Because there was so much, but I love the friction. So I know other people listening have not read two of your books in this, but does he get together with the paramedic and what happens with the dog? I mean, come on. It's you don't have to tell me.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, and the dog is one of the few real characters in that book. So,
wondered that.
My dog was Lobo, and some of the goofy things that Lobo does, like diving for rocks in the river, Lobo did. So he's the one true character. And I'm just about to start book 6 in the series, and Lobo is still there going strong. He actually becomes Brad's partner, really.
He would. Yeah. I mean, obviously that's what you're gunning for this to happen.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's go back and talk about you. You had the conversation with the doctor where all of a sudden the dam explodes. Take us through that, because you said, you know, for like a year and a half, you could just cry or you'd be at the dinner table and something would get triggered. So take us through what helped you to continue to get through and still continue to get through. I mean, I don't think PTSD, you know, you could have a trigger later from something, but what was the most helpful for you and how did you set that up?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head earlier when you said that when I went to my family doctor, that was a safe place.
Yeah.
So that was important. And I don't want to be negative about this, but that then became the hardest thing, was finding the next person to trust. Mm. And I'm sure, you know, the U.S. system is similar to Canada's in that if you're being sponsored by work to go to counseling, the goal is to get you back to work. Yeah. It's to get you off the long-term, short-term disability and back to work. So it took me a while to realize that the counselor really wasn't on my side. That the goal of, they got lots of pressure to get me off the books and back to work. And the first guy spent a lot of time saying, so what do you think about going back to work? And at that point I said, well, yeah, absolutely. So when he wrote his final report after 5 months, he said, Dwayne's excited to get back to work. And so I said, okay, you're going back to work. I go, whoa, not yet. Well, but the counselor said that you often said, I often said, I want to go back to work. I didn't say like now, or I'm ready to go right now. So, so that was the challenge. And the one counselor that I found on my own that I was working with, the corporation wouldn't endorse that person to look after me. So it had to be one of their people. So that was the challenge, and it's still the challenge. It's still tough finding people to trust. I would say that generally police officers and paramedics are less trusting of people in general than the general people are, just because of the experiences we've had. The best counselors would be paramedics and police officers who have gone through the PTSD and have been on the job and know exactly what you're talking about. The one counselor I had, I think he was more enamored by my past of the things he had done. And he was always asking me about, well, tell me about, you know, when you're on the TAC team, you know, what was that like? And I was like, he was more interested in my career because it was exciting than the issues I was having. So that's a challenge. And there's times when you know, you're down and you want to talk to somebody, and there's, you know, people I've worked with, I know have PTSD, but you don't really want to, you want to call them because they know, you don't want to call them because you don't want to trigger them.
Yep.
So you don't want to bring them down with what's brought you down. And so you're hesitant. And so still to this day, I keep too much inside because I don't know where to let it go. I don't have the place always to let it go. I can't go to my family doctor all the time. She's got, you know, 500 other patients she needs to see, and she has 7 minutes for me, and I need an hour and a half, darn it. That's a challenge. I think for me, writing helps.
Oh, 100%.
Strangely, it helped. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It can be pretty cathartic, and I'm so glad, because you're writing about whether, you know, Lobo was a real dog and this situation really happened or whatever. You're still fictionalizing it, and I would think that that would help you process. Have you ever tried EMDR or you have?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Was it not for you?
With the one counselor that I said I found and worked with, it was very helpful. And another counselor that I had, it wasn't so helpful, because that person had a sore shoulder. And so, you know, there's some arm movement within it. It was just kind of this little movement that was happening, which was more distracting than anything else. And so that was the ups and downs of the people I saw. So yes, the EMDR was great with one counselor. Yeah.
I'm an NLP practitioner. So I work with people so that you don't have to tell me your story, which is great, because then you're not reliving it.
Yes.
And I love that work on the unconscious mind, because I don't want to relive my traumas any more than you do.
Yeah.
You know, that's not fun.
Yeah, and that is hard the first couple of times when you're walking through that event. You're not verbalizing it, but you're essentially visualizing it.
You are.
I'm going through it again and then again and then again and then again, but you know changing the story, so to speak.
Yeah.
But so that was good. Yeah.
Other than writing, and that you've tried several therapies, which is fantastic, what have been other things that were helpful? How did it impact your relationships?
Oh, yeah, that was a tough one. Again, you know, the initial year plus going through it, I still wasn't aware of the impact I was having on other people. Mm. Now, I really didn't want to be around other people for the most part. So my partner would say, hey, we should have this couple over for dinner. And I go, oh, you know, maybe not this weekend, you know, maybe next weekend. Because the thought of having to pull myself up and carry on a conversation 2 hours just seemed overwhelming. Later on, I did ask my partner what she thought, how I was and how it impacted her. And she's so sweet to me and supports me so much. She said, well, you were pretty delicate.
I mean, that's probably never something you thought anyone would ever say about
nobody,
you.
Nobody would ever say that about me. No. Most likely to kill or something like that, but not delicate. But I get what, you know, what she was seeing was the spontaneous crying, the person who was okay 1 minute and all of a sudden, what the heck, he's lying on the bed curled up in a ball and not understanding it. She doesn't have, you know, the background, and we've talked about it lots, but it was hard for her to process too. And I think probably for a year and a half, maybe 2 years, I really wasn't around.
Okay. Interesting. She said you were dull. I'm just still going to laugh about that, but I mean, how great. And that just shows how unlike you were.
Yeah.
And yeah. I imagine that would have been really, really difficult. So for people out there that are dealing with a loved one who's struggling with PTSD, or that's the concern, one thing is they're very uncharacteristic of the person that you know, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was the guy, I loved the challenge. So I would, I'd have six balls kind of going in the air, six projects, and my boss would come in and toss two more at me, and I would just laugh at him, go, yeah, right, like that's going to get me down. And then once I was in this, one thing was too much, like having to do one thing. You have to prepare dinner tonight. Oh my God, well, what am I going to make? I mean, like, do we have hamburgers or do we have pork chops, or we had rice last night. We can't have rice. It was just like overwhelming. This one silly little thing I had to do. And there's still times, I guess the other kind of saying I've come up with is I miss me. I know how I was 10 years ago and I know where I am now. And it's not the same. And so that's tough. And it's, like you said, this will stick with me for my life now. And I've done things, I'm doing things to make it better, but I don't think I'll ever be back to the guy who juggles 10 things and laughs at it, because it's no big deal to do. I can usually pick dinner now. So I can pick dinner and even decide that I'm going to, vacuum the floor too. So I can do two things at the same time.
Stop. I mean, we laugh, but that's a really hard thing. What helped you move forward to be able, because you knew you didn't want to do anything, and then one thing was overwhelming, and now you can do several, and you set yourself a schedule for writing, which is massive. That's massive. So I think that's a massive thing, and far different from who you were before. So you've done all of this transitioning. What were the steps that helped get you there?
Well, I think it was the baby steps, like you were saying. I mean, I guess it's almost, you can go with the stages of grief to throw it in there. I mean, there was denial, there was anger, and eventually I accept where I am but I'm still angry about it, if that makes sense. I don't like where I am because I want to be back to where I was. But most of me knows I won't get back there. But part of me still thinks there's still a chance. And sometimes I am still angry and frustrated at where I am. And there's, you know, I do have an aggressive writing schedule, but February was a bad month. I didn't do much in February. Okay. And so instead of letting that happen, I was mad at me because I wasn't keeping to the schedule that I had set out and was upset because I just couldn't. It just, and I tried all the things that I usually do to pop out of it, and I just couldn't. So I don't know whether that was because February is a horrible month anyway, and everybody hates February, spring, or, you know, all of that together, but it wasn't a great month. I couldn't pull myself back out of it. And now I have. So it's arguing with yourself about, here's where you are. You need to accept it. And that little bit that's saying, no, you don't.
Well, I love the part that pushes you forward to be better than you are, the best version of yourself, and the part that allows some grace too. And those probably aren't always playing in the sandbox real well.
That's right. Yeah.
So on the horizon, I'm really interested in, you tried to go publisher route, you went self-publishing. Now you're going with a publisher again. I am personally super curious about this. I've thought about doing that. And every time I think about it, I'm like, it's a tough one to go to publishing from self-publishing. What makes you excited and happy about that? And what are the expectations with that? Are they keeping you to a better schedule? Is it more accountability?
Well, I think one thing is I would like the weight of a publisher behind me. Not that it's like it was in the big old days where you went on a grand tour and all that sort of stuff. But as an independent publisher, getting people to buy your books is very, very hard.
Hard.
I don't have any bad reviews. People love my book. They bug me because I'm on Facebook goofing off when I should be writing the next book because they're waiting for it. And it's a very loyal following, but very small. And I'm just having troubles breaking into kind of international, breaking out of my local area market. So part of me thinks that, well, maybe a publisher would be able to help with that. The other thing that's making it easy, though, is The Laughing Dog. I loved writing it. Mm-hmm. It's almost like I'm one book ahead. So it's not that it's not a throwaway book by any means, but I'm also not going to spend 4 years getting a publisher. Right. So I'm going to put it out. I had an agent before. I'll see if she wants to look into it. There's a couple other people who said they would pass it on to their either agents or procurement people.
Right.
And if in, you know, a year I don't have any bites, then I'm going to publish it. So it's not like I'm not saying, darn it, I'm going to get this one traditionally published. I'm going to give it, this is terrible. I'm going to give the traditional publishers an opportunity to have my book. If they choose not to pick it up, that's on them. It will still get published. So,
I love that. I have somebody I'll connect you with in the comments of the live video on Facebook, that I tagged you on it, and I will connect somebody. I know somebody in the regular traditional publishing. It's not real.
No, it's
and
fictional.
I love her. I love Randy, and I think she's great. And I've talked to her about it before. And I know with the second book that I'm writing, I could go that route. And I can't even tell you how much I'm uncertain if that's a good idea. So I know a lot of us battle with that, but I love your perspective on it. That's fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've got it over my shoulder. There's my books.
Yeah,
so,
I know.
You know, I'm going to be sending that to them as my seventh or eighth book. So it's not like I'm brand new. So
no,
I published myself. You can look at the ratings. You can see my ratings on any platform. Right. So if you're interested, read it. Let me know. Right. If you're not, then let me know and watch it come out a year from now and be a bestseller. So,
but don't rate it on Amazon because you really mess up our stats over term. Please. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. That's my motto with ratings and reviews. Like, just walk away. Don't be mean.
I know. Yeah, you
really got screws
you got 25s and 1-4, and you go, why did you put that 4 in there? I had a perfect rating. Come on.
My podcast reviews, I've got like a 4.8 because one person like 3.5 years ago did a 3-star review, and all the comments was the word E-H. Eh.
Yeah.
And it's like, I will never get a 5-star because this one person, I'm like, really? You couldn't have just written to me and said, or just shut up? What's the matter with people? I don't understand.
That was crisis point. I had one person, I can't remember if it was a 4 or a 3, and the very first line says, I don't read this genre. Well, then put it down and stay off Amazon.
That's what I mean. Like, it's just like, don't say anything if you don't like it. Just move on to somebody else. But if you like it, leave a review.
Tell everybody.
Dwayne, whether it's the subject of PTSD or switching careers or being an author or a writer, pick anything you want. What is the best piece of advice you would like to leave us with today?
Well, actually, I'm going to go with the writing part.
Okay.
And the key is just write. And whether it's a paragraph, a sentence, 10 words, 20 words, 30 words, whatever it is, if you're interested in writing, then the only way to do this is to write. They said, I think it was Wayne Gretzky or somebody said, you know, you miss every shot you don't take. So, you know, in writing, every word that you don't write is an unwritten word, and you'll be surprised how fast they will stack up. You'll be surprised how easy it becomes and what enjoyment you can get out of it. And the interesting thing is when you hit a bad day and you think, oh, my brain's not working, I shouldn't write today, write anyway, because when you come back and edit later, you'll never be able to pick out that day that you had a bad day, because the first draft isn't that great most of the time anyway. There'll be some great stuff and there'll be some bad stuff, but you'll write bad stuff on good days too.
Right.
So just get it down on paper and set yourself, you know, whatever you're going to do. I'm going to write 100 words a day. That's perfect. I'm going to write, you know, I can't write during the week, but on the weekend, I'm going to write 1,000 words on Saturday, 1,000 words on Sunday. Perfect. Whatever it is that fits in with you. So if you want to write, just write.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on it. So much fun visiting with you again.
Oh, great. Oh, it was great to be back. Thank you.